Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. Today is July the 24th, 2019. On this day in history, July 24th, 1969, Apollo 11 returns to Earth from its historic first man landing on the moon. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, and Amazon are using your personal data? Is that product you bought from Amazon a counterfeit? You should find out. Our website is pcradioshow.org, and we can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet, as well as on various podcast hosting sites. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm on the Internet and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the number is 641-793-7091. And for those who are listening to the program on demand, you can leave us a message with your question or comments to hank@pcradioshow.org. You can also reach us on Google number 862-800-6805. Start your message with the Personal Computer Show, followed by your message. Google recently removed several apps from the Google Play Store after discovering they violated the Play Store Terms of Service and, more importantly, could be used as stalkerware. That doesn't mean that they've deleted from your Android device, though, so now is a great time to remove them. If you're unfamiliar with the phrase stalkerware, it involves giving a third party access to another user device, location data, and other sensitive information. These apps often present themselves as normal tracking tools. For employee activity on company phones or your children's whereabouts. But they can also be used to spy on romantic partners, friends, or roommates. These apps run afoul of Google's policies for apps distributed as Google Play. Surveillance and commercial spyware apps are explicitly prohibited on Google Play. Only policy-compliant apps exclusively designed and marketed for parental monitoring or enterprise management may distribute on the store with tracking and reporting features, provided they fully comply with the requirements described below. As part of these requirements, tracking apps must clearly show that they're active and cannot mislead users about their purpose. In other words, apps that try to hide on a user's device and send their location data to someone else are a no-go. Security company Avast was responsible for highlighting these 7 stalkerware apps to Google, which they should remove from your Android device if you see them. They are Employee Work Spy, Mobile Tracking, Phone Cell Tracker, SMS Tracker, Spy Kids Tracker, Spike Tracker, and Track Employees Check Work Phone Online Spy Free. If you don't see them but suspect your movements are being tracked in some fashion, considering performing a factory reset on your device. You'll have to reinstall your apps and you'll want to back up critical data like your photos and videos before you kick off the reset. But it's the best and easiest way to ensure that hidden apps aren't hiding and tracking your whereabouts. Once you have your new device set up, make sure you're using a stronger unlocking method so someone can't get back in and reinstall any tracking tools. News on the electronics consumer retail front. Amazon Prime Day was a roaring success for, well, everyone. Amazon wrapped up its 5th annual birthday extravaganza last week, and according to a statement released by Amazon, the 2-day event, exclusively for Amazon Prime members around the world, saw the company's sales surpass that of most recent Black Friday and Cyber Monday shopping days combined. According to data from Adobe Analytics, Prime Day 2019 smashed the e-commerce giant's 2-day sales totals, achieving roughly $5 billion in sales. Amazon reported that Prime members scooped up more than 175 million items throughout the event, As for the specific electronics items that perform well on Amazon, the company reported that more than 100,000 laptops were purchased over the 2 days, along with more than 200,000 TVs and 300,000 headphones. Alexa-enabled devices stole the show for the company. Prime Day was the most successful day for those devices on record. Consumers purchased 2 times as many Ring and Blink devices as last year, 2 times as many Fire TV Edition smart TVs as last year, and more Fire tablets and Kindles than any day in the company's history. Smart home devices in particular move well throughout Prime Day. Consumers purchased millions of smart home devices. Diving deeper into the Adobe data regarding Prime Day 2019, it became clear that the wider retail community looked to capitalize on the Amazon-created Black Friday in July event. Prime Day has become an indisputable summer shopping holiday, greatly benefiting online retailers that can attract consumers to their site through compelling email campaigns or offering value-added services like buy online and pick it up in the store. Due to its halo effect, large retailers with major discounts online reap the benefits of Prime Day or so, while niche retailers also saw a significant increase in online sales. This suggests that people are comparison shopping more than ever and will open up their wallets to those who offer the best deals, regardless of the size of the retailer. So while Prime Day created a massive win for Amazon, it's clear through Adobe's data that consumers are willing to window shop Amazon deals and look for better prices elsewhere. It speaks to the fact that traditional retailers are finally starting to catch up with the e-commerce game. What did I buy on Prime Day? Nothing. In consumer electronics, the product life cycle is short, and when advanced products are introduced, they cost less than the present product they replace. How do you know when you're buying only because the sale price was unbelievably low? Review the inventory of consumer electronics you have in the house. Just look at what items have been sitting idle or still have the original price tag on. Buying items in bulk can be more expensive than buying only the quantity of the product when you need it. I just look at all the new boxes of floppy diskettes waiting to be used, or the number of packs of blank DVDs and CD optical media that's sitting on the shelf. I still have new, well, let's call it unused, 5.25-inch floppy disk drives. Who uses them now? Buy it when you need it helps you to avoid being a hoarder. Of course, if you follow my example, this may hurt the economy.
Web browser extensions are leaking personal data. As many as 4 million people have web browser extensions that sell their every click. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. Even more terrifying, it's happening because of software you probably installed yourself. As many as 4 million people have been leaking personal and corporate secrets through Chrome and Firefox. When told, browser makers Google and Mozilla shut these leaks immediately, but it's only probably a fraction of the problem. Extensions are little programs also known as add-ons and plugins. They hang out in the top right corner of your browser. These browser extensions are little programs used by nearly half of all desktop web surfers to make browsing better, such as finding coupons or remembering passwords. People install them assuming that any software offered in a store run by Chrome or Firefox has got to be legit. Not at all. From a privileged perch in your browser, they pass information about where you surf and what you view into a murky data economy. Think about everything you do in your browser at work and home. It's a digital proxy for your brain. Now imagine those clicks beaming out your computer to be harvested for marketers, data brokers, or hackers. Some extensions make surveillance sound like a sweet deal. Amazon was offering people $10 to install its assistant extension. In the fine print, Amazon said, "The extension collects your browsing history and what's on the pages you view. Though all that data stays inside the giant company,
Academic researchers said there are thousands of extensions that gather browsing data, many with loose or downright deceptive data practices. Lurking in the online stores of Google and even the more privacy-friendly Mozilla. The extensions selling your data show just how dangerous browser surveillance can be. Here's exactly how millions of people's data got grabbed and sold, and the failed safeguards from browser makers that let it happen. There is a website called Nacho Analytics, just one small player in the data economy. Nacho builds itself on its website as a marketing intelligence service. It offers data about what's being clicked on at almost any website, including actual web addresses, for as little as $49 a month. That data, Nacho claims, comes from people who opt in to be tracked, and it redacts personally identifiable information. Nacho gathers usernames, passwords, and GPS coordinates, even though Nacho said it scrubs personal information from its data. To see and remove Chrome extensions that you've got installed, just do the following. Type Chrome:// extensions, or in Firefox, type About:add-ons. When the leaks became known to browser makers, Google remotely deactivated 7 extensions and Mozilla did the same to 2 others. Together, they tallied more than 4 million users. If you had any of them installed, they should no longer work. In Chrome, previously installed extensions that have been banned by Google are disabled and given a warning label. A few days later, after the shutdown, Nacho Analytics posted a notice on the website that it had suffered a permanent data outage and would no longer take on new clients or provide new data for existing ones. But that doesn't mean that the problem is over. North Carolina University researchers recently tested how many of the 180,000 available Chrome extensions leak privacy-sensitive data. They found 3,800 such extensions, and the 10 most popular alone have more than 60 million users. Not all of these companies are malicious or doing this on purpose, but they have the ability to sell your data if they want. There is no regulation that prevents them from doing this. Alexa has been eavesdropping on you this whole time. So why aren't Google and Mozilla stopping it? Researchers have been calling out nefarious extensions for years, and the companies say they vet what's in their stores, and they say that we want Chrome extensions to be safe and privacy-preserving, and detecting policy violations is essential to that effort, said Google. Google recently announced that it would begin requiring extensions to minimize the data they access. Among other technical changes, Mozilla said its recent focus has also been on limiting the damage add-ons can do. Just as big a problem is a data industry that's grown cavalier about turning your lives into its raw material. The defense from Nacho Analytics boiled down to this. It's just the way the internet works. Large swaths of the tech industry treat tracking as an acceptable way to make money. Whether most of us realize what's really going on, Amazon will give you a $10 coupon for it. Google tracks your searches and even your activity in Chrome to build a lucrative dossier on you. Facebook, as everyone knows, does the same with your activity in its apps. Of course, those companies don't usually leave your personal information hanging out there in the open internet for sale. But just because it's hidden doesn't mean that it's any less scarier. What can you do about it? Don't allow any extensions. However, this is easier said than done because some of the websites do require the installation of selected plugins. China scrambles to stem manufacturing exodus as 50 companies leave. To counter tariff blow, government eases restrictions and offers perks. A Nikkei survey found that more than 50 global companies have shifted or are considering shifting production from China in response to the U.S. trade dispute. China's racing to keep foreign enterprises in country, dangling special benefits so that the advantages of staying outweighs the heavy tariffs imposed by the United States. A year into the traffic war with Washington, more than 50 global companies, including Apple and Nintendo, have announced or are considering plans to move production out of China. And not just foreign companies, Chinese manufacturers, as well as those from the United States, Japan, and Taiwan, are part of the drain, including makers of personal computers, smartphones, and other electronics. We need permanent measures to avoid the risk of tariffs to be eligible for U.S. government procurement, says the CEO PC maker Dynabook. The unit of Sharp is considering a plan to relocate production of the U.S.-bound notebooks PCs to a new plant being built in Vietnam. Such PCs accounts for 10% of the unit's total notebook production. Dynabook makes almost all its notebooks PCs in China, mainly at a plant in Hangzhou, southwest of Shanghai. Although the fourth round of U.S. tariffs have been temporarily shelved, they said that they cannot tell what will happen nor when it can be lifted. Apple has called on major suppliers to consider moving 15 to 30% of iPhone production out of the country. The Nikkei Asian Review reported Wednesday that Apple is about to start trial production of its popular AirPods, wireless earbuds, in Vietnam. Trials such as these are usually precursors to mass production. American PC makers HP and Dell are thinking of moving up to 30% of their notebook production in China to Southeast Asia and elsewhere. Japan Nintendo will also shift a portion of the Nintendo Switch game system production from China to Vietnam. There is concern that these moves could squeeze Chinese employment and consumption. To minimize the blow, Beijing is rolling out the red carpet for foreign businesses. Tesla is at the forefront of such government efforts. The company is now moving equipment into its new plants on the outskirts of Shanghai, on which it broke ground just a half a year ago, and it's hiring workers to staff its lines starting as early as next month. The American electric car maker is believed to have secured the land of a discount from the local government and likely receive lending on the cheap as well. China has been gradually opening up to overseas businesses since 2018 when trade tensions with the U.S. deepened. Foreign direct investment into China increased 3.5% on the year to about $70.7 billion for the January-June half, according to its Commerce Ministry. The country announced in late June that it would ease restrictions on foreign investment in seven fields, including oil and gas. It is also working to bring forward plans to opening up the financial sector. Whether these are enough to offset the impact of the trade war is unclear. At the UE Furniture main factory, which is west of Shanghai, employees start to file out of the building around 4:30 p.m. And one is heard to be saying, "We are no longer working overtime because of the tariffs." The company has decided to set up production facilities in Vietnam to avoid American tariffs. It appears not to have cut staff at home so far, but many employees face shrinking earnings from shorter hours. Concern over the situation is growing among political leaders. China's State Council decided in May to set up a group to lead employment measures and plans to bolster job training programs using surplus funds from state insurance schemes. The trade dispute is beginning to show up in flow of goods and capital, and in the first 5 months of the year, exports from China to the United States fell 12% on the year in value terms, while those from India, Vietnam, and Taiwan logged double-digit gains. Exports aimed at bypassing U.S. tariffs by disguising the origin of products may also be increasing. Many companies, alarmed by the prospect of a prolonged trade conflict, are hedging their bets. While looking for alternative production sites for U.S.-bound goods, many will keep factories operating in China for the domestic Chinese market. Thus, many manufacturers will be forced to set up dual supply chains, one for China and one for the other markets, raising their costs and denting profits. The possibility of a world market dividing into China and non-China is growing. Decoupling, that is an unwinding of economic ties between U.S. and China and a division of the world economy into hostile blocs, is a real possibility. Other than higher costs, companies will likely face excess capacity in a decoupled world economy. Quanta Computer, which is a Taiwanese contract manufacturer of PCs, including Apple's MacBook, is set to shift some operations to Taiwan. But negotiations with client companies over the cost of relocation are expected to be difficult. Quanta cannot afford a further decline in its already low profit margin. A Japanese machinery maker has shifted production for the U.S. market to a Southeast Asian country. Because the new location does not have as extensive supply chain as China, they need to either transport parts from China or to establish a new procurement network. In either case, costs will rise. Since last July, the U.S. government has imposed three rounds of new tariffs on Chinese imports, covering 27 trillion yens or $250 billion worth of goods. Although the fourth round, covering virtually all goods shipped from China, is on hold, companies need to prepare for the worst. Much of the shift is to Southeast Asia, especially Vietnam, which is becoming home to many manufacturers of electrical and electronic equipment. Among them is South Korea's Samsung Electronics, which makes smartphones in the country. Vietnam also offers logistic advantages because it shares a land border with China. Japan's Kyocera is thinking of transferring printer production to Vietnam. Chinese electronics maker TCL will set up a TV plant in the country. Manufacturers are moving production back to take advantage of existing procurement networks for exports aimed at large developed country markets. Komatsu has partially shifted output of parts for construction equipment to Japan, and the United States companies are also working to raise productivity of their plants by promoting digitization and automation. Lucipher ransomware, decrypted, gets your files back for free. A decryptor for the Lucipher ransomware has been released by Emisoft that allows victims to decrypt their files for free. If you were infected with Lucipher, that's spelled L-O-O-C-I-P-H-E-R, do not pay the ransom. Lucipher is installed through malicious Word documents that download the executable and execute it. Once executed, the ransomware will encrypt a victim's data and append the .lcphr extension to the encrypted file names. The ransomware would then display a Lucipher decryptor screen that contains a countdown until your key will be allegedly deleted, as well as the button to check if a payment has been made. If you are infected with this ransomware, you can get your files back for free. Type in a search for Lucipher ransomware and a program will be available. If you were infected with Lucipher ransomware and still have the encrypted files, simply download the decrypt_lucipher.exe program. That's decrypt_lucipher.exe program. The decryptor was created by Michael Gillespie with the assistance from Francesco Moroni. This decryptor does not need the Lucipher.exe program running, so if it is still running, you should just terminate the process and delete the file so it does not start again. Once downloaded, run the program with administrative privileges in order to decrypt all the files that were targeted by the ransomware. Once started, agree to the license agreement and you will be at the brute forcer screen where it asks you to select an encrypted file with the same file in the unencrypted form. Now that we have a decryptor for C and Grab, and more recently, there was also released a decryptor for PyLocky, that's PyLocky, and now for Lucipher, the odds of you getting hit by ransomware and being held up has decreased, but we should still be on alert to be careful of how we download files.
WhatsApp infects millions of Android phones with malware. About 25 million Android phones were infected with malware, hidden inside WhatsApps, according to an article from Forbes. Essentially, the virus replaced certain apps with fake versions that bombard the user with ads. Because it is copying and replacing apps with a malicious version, the malware virus has been named Agent Smith, based on the character from The Matrix. How did this happen and what is it doing? A third-party app store called 9, that's numeric 9, APPS, 9apps.com, is responsible for the spread. If you downloaded your apps from the Play Store, you should be safe. You can still download WhatsApp from the website. As of now, the only thing that the malware appears to be doing is bombarding the user with malicious ads. However, Agent Smith has lots of harmful potential. Since it can hide in plain sight, the virus can present privacy risk without the user knowledge of what's happening. Most of the infected Android phones are in India, about 15 million of them. However, there are about 300,000 infected phones in the United States and about 137,000 in the UK. What should you do? If you download anything from 9apps.com, you should uninstall all of those apps immediately just to be safe. Although WhatsApp was the main app infected with Agent Smith, there may have been others. You should also regularly scan your phone for viruses. Free apps like Malwarebytes can do just that for you. Recently, Senator Chris Coons, who's a Democrat from Delaware, sent a letter to Amazon with privacy concerns about Alexa. Specifically, Coons asked about how long Alexa keeps user data and how they use it. Amazon responded by saying that Amazon keeps transcripts of interactions with Alexa and in some cases keep them even after customers deleted them. As Coons later tweeted, Amazon was not clear about what is done with these transcripts and who is it being sent to. Why does Alexa record conversations in the first place? As Amazon said in the letter to Coons, Alexa is constantly evolving and getting smarter. In order to do this, it needs to learn more about human language to better understand. Training Alexa with voice recordings and transcripts from a diverse range of customers helps ensure Alexa works well for everyone. However, there is already evidence of our conversations being used for malicious purposes. It was recently revealed that Amazon employees, that's right, Amazon employees are listening in on us through Alexa and are sharing conversations they are finding that are interesting with other employees. That's not appropriate at all. The idea that Amazon employees could possibly be hearing intimate moments in our homes and are sharing them is very disconcerting. Well, how do you delete the conversations that Alexa recorded? Do a search on Amazon space Alexa and you could download from there. From here, you can listen to the recordings and delete whichever ones you like. However, according to the letter from Amazon, not all transcripts will be deleted. For example, the letter said that transcripts that deal with transactions often won't be deleted even if you manually delete them. According to the letter, deleting those completely could stop routines from occurring and are required for transactions. As these were just examples, what now begs to be seen is what other conversations is Alexa keeping and who is she sending them to. Alexa is shaped like a hockey puck, and there are times I just want to slapshot it as far away as possible. The problem is that Amazon is far from the only company that has serious privacy concerns. Apple products have been known to record us, and don't even get me started on Facebook. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell on his continuing IT Pro series, Prevention, Not Waiting Till Something Breaks.
Technology in the workplace is abundant. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Now, I'm going to cover some of the different things with work technology and how it mixes, how it combines with a personal technology. Now, computers need maintenance. We need to maintain all of the technology that we're dealing with throughout our lives, there are so many different things we need to do. We need to make sure that, yes, we're getting enough airflow and making sure that everything's up to date. We're watching for malware. We're watching for different patches that need to be done. And sometimes, okay, so there's updates and there's patches. What are patches? Patches are basically fixes to something that went wrong. Think bug fixes. Think a matter of a vulnerability fix. Something's wrong and somebody can get into our system. And a update is making sure that we're on the latest version of the software. Not so much patches and bugs, but think of the different versions of Windows or Mac OS or iOS or Android operating system. So Windows 7, Windows Vista, Windows 10. So those are updates. And then the patches would be the different little things that we add in, the little bug fixes. So that's just a number of different items. And we need to watch each of the different computers. We need to watch everything that goes on with computers and make sure that nothing is likely to go wrong. You may have heard this before. Benjamin Franklin said, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Spending just a little bit of time once a week, double checking on certain things, can keep our technology, our computers, our systems running properly. In a proper IT environment, an IT manager will delegate or will take part in or will cover the different things that need to be watched. So we watch for, yes, is a server throwing all kinds of errors? What kind of errors are they? Well, and this is just not the server. There are all kinds of different components that are involved with the technology. We monitor networks. We will set up network monitors that will watch the traffic and say, oh, hey, you've got a network storm. And what is a network storm? That's where basically one computer reaches out to another computer, but then the data, the request for data, gets spun around and it starts building up on the network because some router, some different switch out there says, oh, it's in that direction. But the other switches say, no, it's in your direction. And then they get in a big fight. Well, eventually those packets of information just disappear. They're told, you know, after a certain amount of jumps, don't bother anymore. But the original computer, the initial computer making that request, it sits there and it goes, yeah, I still need that data. So I don't know why I didn't hear from anybody, so I'm going to ask again. And all of this happens in the matter of split seconds. And within a moment, a network storm can appear. So with the right IT processes, all of the different issues that might come up can be planned for, they can be detected, they can be predicted even, and they can be resolved before they become an absolute nightmare. Now, with all kinds of technology, we need to make sure that we're always getting in front of the issues. We are always supposed to be looking forward, trying to find out what could go wrong. Let's say you get an error message on your computer, your home computer, your desktop computer at the office. And this error message says, hey, we're having a problem with a hard drive. What happens if you ignore that message? What happens if you just say, ah, it's fine, it'll solve itself? Well, the reality is, they usually don't solve themselves. Usually somebody has to get in there and press buttons and go, oh, it's this problem, it's that problem. Or they detect an issue and they say, oh, there's nothing that we can do to tweak it software-wise. We actually have to replace this particular piece of hardware. It happens all the time. It happens on a far more frequent basis than you might imagine. An IT professional worth his weight in salt will address these issues, but also will watch for them. They'll predict where they're coming from, where they're going to happen. And there's a lot of different software packages that are available out there. Some of the things I've dealt with over the years, there's a company called Pessler, P-A-E-S-S-L-E-R. They put out PRTG, Network Monitor. You don't have to really know this. There's a company called Spiceworks. They put out a nice inventory software and a ticketing software, but some of the different things that it does will track some of the issues on your network. Now, this is the nerd side. This is the techie side. On your own system, what is it that you can do? Well, you can check your event viewer. You can also make sure that you've got up-to-date malware software. I can't stress this enough. If you paid for McAfee, Norton, Trend, ESET, whatever it is you paid for 5 years ago, but you haven't paid for it since, your malware software is probably out of date. What does that mean? It's not updating. It's not getting any of the different files that it needs to protect your system. It's just sitting there, and it's protecting you with five-year-old technology, five-year-old data. You know, when I go to the doctor, I want to know that my doctor is up to date with the latest in regards to whatever malady I might be experiencing. I want him to know the right cure, the right solution. And if he doesn't know, I could die, right? Same thing with your computer. Your malware software, it's not up to date. Yeah. So those are just two different areas that you can take part in watching your computer. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank. This is Benjamin Rockwell, and you're listening to Computer Talk Radio.
Thank you, Benjamin. The U.S. consumer tech market is on a pace to exceed $400 billion in retail revenues this year. This is according to the Consumer Technology Association. U.S. Consumer Technology Sales and Forecast Report reflects U.S. factory sales to dealers for 300-plus consumer tech products and related software and services. This year, the CTA is pointing towards the rise in streaming services, artificial intelligence-enabled emerging devices, and in-vehicle technology as main drivers of the 2.2% increase over a year-to-year period. Enthusiasm for AI-powered technology is skyrocketing. More consumers are discovering for themselves how tech innovation can change their daily lives for the better. And with the 5G delivering the faster connectivity we'll need for anytime, anywhere streaming, smarter home robotics and more advanced vehicles, consumer excitement will only grow. But unnecessary tariffs, taxes paid by American consumers, and businesses threaten to slow down our nation's economic momentum. In the report, CTA breaks down the consumer tech products into two main categories: emerging technologies and revenue drivers. The highest grossing product category under emerging tech includes an array of connected home products. Smart home safety devices, smart speakers, and home robots are collectively expected to generate $8.7 billion in revenue. Following closely behind them, though, are wireless earbuds, $2 billion market, and smart watches, $5.4 billion. Revenue drivers include veterans like smartphones, laptops, and televisions, as the largest consumer tech category by far. Smartphones are expected to rake in $77.5 billion in revenue in 2019. Though this number actually represents a 2% decline, more than ever, consumers want premium technology experiences, especially within the smartphone, TV, laptop, smartwatch, and wireless earbud categories. The lightning-fast pace of tech means we can upgrade our everyday tech and get extraordinary experiences, while this level of quality and efficiency means some replacement cycles are starting to get longer. Technologies such as AI and 5G promise to usher in the next era of innovation, delighting consumers and driving our economy. One of the things that Apple has long prided itself on consumer loyalty, particularly around its flagship device, the iPhone. However, data from Bank Myself found that, at least in the most recent quarter, customer loyalty to the iPhone dropped significantly. Bank Myself, a service that let consumers sell their used phones and upgrade to a new one, collected data from over 38,000 people trading in their phones since October of 2018. A relatively limited sample size, however, in the grand scheme of things, and used that information to track Apple brand loyalty during the iPhone upgrade cycle. Bank myself found that iPhone retention dropped 15.2% compared to the March of 2018. 29% of iPhone customers swapped their iPhone X's for another brand, while only 7.7% of Samsung Galaxy S9 users switched over to the Apple. In June, 18% of customers who traded in their iPhones did so for a Samsung device. Bank Mycel then cross-referenced its data with stats from other companies. The firm determined that customer loyalty right now is roughly 73%, compared with an all-time high of 92% as recently as 2017. There hasn't been a ton of great news for the smartphone market in general. The market finds itself in a bit of a sticky-wicky situation at the moment, as global shipments are essentially in free fall. A Gartner report this week found that the global phone shipments faced their worst decline ever in 2019. The firm expects shipments of mobile devices to decline by 68 million devices this year, which is more than both the tablet and PC market combined. As consumers hold onto their mobile devices longer, brands have attempted to combat the slowdown by launching the higher-end, higher-priced devices, a move that is likely to help keep revenue up in the short term, but may force even longer refresh cycle in the years to come. Presenting Marty Winston on Dumb Backup, the smart choice to dodge cyber attacks. There's hacking, phishing, and ransomware attacks, which the main goal is relieving you of your money. But the goals of cyber warfare are about disrupting life as we know it. It's real, and it's happening now, and it's not fake news. Marty Winston has a specific suggestion about something that can be done differently with computer systems that can block widespread disruption at the cost of some minor inconvenience just by turning off a commonly deployed feature.
How much do you know about cyber warfare? I'm not talking about cyber warfare as a plot device in TV shows or movies. I'm talking about real-world cyber warfare. There aren't many people who really know very much, but here's something that everybody should know. It's real. And there's some of it happening now, at least at a skirmish level. Listen, I'm the farthest thing you can imagine from being a conspiracy theorist. The last time I thought there was a conspiracy, it was when I was starting high school, and I noticed that none of my classes had girls in them, and I would never see any girls in the hallway. Well, you guessed it. Unless you guessed that it was a deodorant or mouthwash issue. Nope, not those. It was an all-boys school. Since then, I've always valued observable reality over imagined conspiracy. So, when major population centers in three different countries all experienced disruptive infrastructure failures in the same weekend, I'm pretty sure it wasn't because they were all running on Windows XP systems where the support had run out. I read that as one of the cyber warfare units somewhere in the world running a sort of test flight on what's termed an attack vector. They chose soft targets, not the same as the skirmishes that are being played out among the main players. For now, Team USA has the all-stars on the field, but it would be a mistake to believe that they own the field. Some of the most formidable competing teams, no, that's too friendly a way to say it. Some of the most formidable forces, many of them true enemies, some less aligned, are in Russia, China, and North Korea, with others in Pakistan, Indonesia, Iran, and beyond. We're not talking about the mercenary Russian hackers with their tired old Nairobi print scams or their ransomware or their video of you and porn sites extortion schemes. Those are just criminals, not combatants. Cyber warfare units may sometimes support some of those criminals as a way to fund other operations, but hey, that's just a splinter in the club they're swinging. Their real goal is disruption, confusion, a sense of powerlessness, a citizenry that believes no one is safe and that their government is impotent. So don't think, for example, of one computer at a time. Think about the power utilities, about communications, about traffic signals, about airports, about sewage treatment plants, about water treatment plants, about hospitals. Pick any two or three and imagine what life would be like if they became suddenly unavailable or worse, beyond failure, beyond non-availability, started working against you. That is how cyber warfare is waged. And in a minute, I'll suggest one measure that can close one attack vector. When I lived in South Carolina, I was within roughly half an hour of one of the units of the U.S. Army Cyber Command, the NSA, and I don't know who else is also at that facility. That facility is now well down the road of a four-year expansion that will quadruple its size and make it the epicenter of all Army Cyber Command operations. I'll bet it gets ringed with new chrome and glass buildings as consultants and contractors set up shop nearby, and that will attract rings of retailers, service businesses, restaurants, and housing. The core Army site is and will be ready to operate off the grid if a natural disaster or an enemy infrastructure attack disrupts it. We're talking about a unit with extremely high awareness of what's really happening. I had very short, very limited briefings from them and from the umbrella U.S. Cyber Command, which selectively coordinates cyber warfare activities among both military and non-military operations, including intelligence. I also did some homework through other sources, so please believe me when I tell you that I'm at least partially aware of what I don't know, and completely aware that it would be foolish for me to disclose everything that I do know. The things I've told you so far are all discoverable through published and public sources. But I've done a deeper dive than most people. Let me ask, when's the last time you talked about it at work? There is scant discussion and minimal documentation of cyber warfare preparations at any level, from military and defense information forces to non-military agencies of governments at every level, to energy and infrastructure companies to general corporate businesses. Really, there's no doubting that such preparations are well underway, at least at some of those places, at least among the most conscientious of those. But broadly, for a more general spate of businesses, few have any grasp on the reality or imminence of the need to consider and prepare. On Madison Avenue, on Wall Street, and across the country, most business people, and this is thanks in part to how movies and TV and entertainment depict cyber warfare, most business people regard it as being all about interception or disruption of data channels or stored data. Listen, America won't screech to a standstill just because you can't order things from Amazon or QVC. Real attack strategies run wider and deeper. Some of it is about denying comfort, denying health, denying transportation, making wealth unavailable, and so on. Some of it has to do with putting businesses out of business temporarily, if not permanently. We know that electrical generation and distribution, for example, are among the top targets, and that's where we can start putting some of the preparations in your hands. Sometimes, consider this, sometimes dumber is smarter. Where power is involved, dumb backup can be the smart choice to dodge cyber attacks. Small generators and small uninterruptible power systems have advantages over their quote-unquote smarter IT-scale server room brethren in that they don't offer IP-connected quote-unquote management functionality. And when you take that IP-connected path away, you deny attackers an entry path for disruption. Dumb and done backup power approaches, properly scaled, may provide more and better protection against cyber warfare or other attacks than the usual, more sophisticated, so-called managed equipment. It's an extremely simple concept that only took a few seconds to explain, but I needed to take the first several minutes to describe the context that makes it not just a good idea, but an important one. The difference to most big IT operations is that they'll need to make sure there's somebody on site 24/7 to throw the breakers if there's ever a need to take the system offline. A similar local control over Ethernet switches and routers may also prove to be smarter than allowing those IP-connected backdoors to them. Either way, not paying the always higher prices for gear with those backdoor so-called management features might even fund that one extra staff slot to manage things on site. Next time, I'll talk about the tenuous relationship between storage and organization. One of them is just about putting things somewhere else, and the other is about being able to find them again. I'll even get into the fine line we all walk between being pragmatic and being hoarders. Better be there. I'll be taking attendance.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. All these computer club meetings are open, free to the public. Brookdale Computer Users Group has a presentation on two tools, Hard Disk Sentinel and iCloud. Presentation on Thursday, July the 25th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. at the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room, 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. The Amateur Computer Group has their general meeting Friday, August the 2nd. Meeting time is 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, located at 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, August the 8th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and the presentation is How to Configure and Set Up a Home and Small Office Network. I will be giving that presentation. It will be at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, room 414, and that's in Manhattan, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group will be meeting Friday, August the 9th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Old Westbury campus of the New York Institute of Technology, otherwise known as NYIT or New York Tech, at the Harry J. Scherer Hall. The Kings Bite Computer Club meets Tuesday, August the 13th, and the meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Park Plaza Restaurant, 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn, New York. The Princeton PC Users Group meets Tuesday, August the 27th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Danbury Area Computer Society has no planned meeting for August, but they will meet September the 3rd at the Danbury Hackerspace, and their meeting time is 7 p.m. at 158 Main Street in Danbury, Connecticut. And we hope to see you at one of these meetings. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the Internet. Podcasts are available from all major podcasting host sites, as well as our website, pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us or commentary on any of our feature segments, just send us your email address with your telephone number, in which we can call you at a convenient hour for playback on the program. If you have any questions for us, just send us your email addressed to Hank at pcradioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.